You are listening to a podcast by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the individual contributor and not necessarily those of HMDT. In this podcast, Dr. Klaus Leis reads extracts of the book As If It Were Life by Philip Manners. The book was edited by Ben Barkell, director of the Wiener Library, and Dr. Klaus Leis. Philip Manners was born in Germany on the 16th of August 1875 and grew up in Berlin, where his father ran a fur trading business, which he joined in 1910. Manners married Gertrude Elias, and together they had four children, Rudolf, Walter, Eva, and Anne-Marie. At the outbreak of World War I, Manners was drafted into the Russian front, where he became a sergeant and was awarded the Iron Cross. After the war, Manners dedicated himself to the fur industry, but this was to end the day after Kristallnacht, when he had to dissolve the business. By 1939, his four children had left the country, and Philip and Gertrude were left alone in Berlin, with increasing anti-Jewish measures restricting all aspects of their lives. In spring 1942, Manners was called up to work in a factory manufacturing nuts and bolts. It was exhausting, but he was on good terms with his co-workers, Jews and non-Jews alike. In July of that year, he was notified while at work that he and his wife were to be deported to Theresienstadt. He writes in his diary of his last days in Berlin.
Thus began the last three agonizing days of our life in Berlin, which are now behind us like an evil nightmare. What can I say or report about them? It is indeed too painful to describe these busy hours during which we separated ourselves from property, possessions, and people. It still seemed inconceivable that we had to give up our entire estate, leave behind everything that we had acquired over the 37 years of our marriage. Every object held a loving memory, every picture told a story, and every piece of furniture was like part of the family. All our possessions were to be appropriated by strangers. They would go through all the drawers and cupboards and throw out things that were worthless to them. Our cherished possessions. Inconceivable. I sat at my desk, my beloved desk, my faithful companion for 37 years, which still had marks on it made by Anne-Marie. I wrote farewell letters to all my friends and stuck our last photos inside the envelopes. They would get them by Wednesday, when they would no longer be able to contact us. I went from room to room. Here the painful farewell to Walter and Lily. There I said my goodbyes to Anne-Marie. Over there Eva embraced us for the last time. There Rudolf's large picture looked out of its silver frame. At 9:30 a.m. there was a loud knocking at the door. I opened up. Gestapo officers. With two Jewish helpers. Our hand luggage was taken away. I went with the men, who were perfectly polite as they inspected all the rooms. They looked in the cabinets and asked if there was any food that might spoil. We hadn't left any behind. I forgot the cash box with 100 Reichsmarks in it. It will make someone's day if they find it. The last minutes in our home. The men urge us to leave. It's time, they say. Without looking back, we go out. The door is locked, and the keys surrender to the caretaker, who is afraid to say goodbye.
The account Manners wrote in Theresienstadt begins where the last days in Berlin end, with the arrival at the little station of Boschowitz, 3 kilometers from Theresienstadt.
On July 23, Berlin Transport 129 arrived at Boschowitz. The 100 passengers were lined up three abreast. Young people wearing stars carried the luggage for those who could not. The suitcases were loaded onto cars, as were, in the end, the disabled. Those of us who were fit enough to walk slowly started down a street that led through a nice, clean neighborhood. There, for the first time, we saw Czech signs next to the German ones. The residents paid no attention to the passers-by. After several months, they were used to the sight. It was a hot day, and we soon felt the weight of our backpacks. Our hands were full holding our bags, and walking was increasingly laborious. At last, like magic, we saw walls and ditches straight ahead. That such a fortress should still exist, almost 200 years old, well preserved, the masonry like new, the deep white ditches of the ramparts lush green underneath. Then the walls came closer together, meeting above a narrow passage guarded by inhabited casemates, the Bauschowitz Gate. We passed through unsuspectingly. Now Theresienstadt, the ghetto, our new home, took us in. As we walked, we saw well-dressed people, pretty young women, and happy children on the streets. One could live here, we thought. It seemed that we had not been lied to in Berlin when the community officials spoke of the paradise of Theresienstadt and congratulated us because we had been privileged to come here instead of being sent to Lublin. We hear the word Schleuse. We didn't understand. We were received into a semicircle of casemates from which sloping passages led upwards. They broadened out into impressive, wide, long rooms with walls that seemed to be a meter thick. Tables. On one side the gendarmes, on the other us. Now the Schleuse began. We understood quickly what it meant and watched, shuddering, as the experienced hands searched every bag, backpack and basket, taking away every valuable item, medicine, scissors, blade sharpeners, and to our horror, carefully filled thermos flasks, cognac, the last strengthening reserve, chocolate, and biscuits all disappeared in a flash. With fearful hearts, we sat on the few narrow benches, waiting to see where our exhausted, broken bodies could finally come to rest. If only we could lie down, stretch out, and sleep. No feelings of hunger or thirst, just sleep. Suddenly again a command. Take your things, now into your quarters.
Soon after his arrival, Manners was summoned to see the commander of the Ghetto Watch, a Jewish ghetto police force. He was instructed to take charge of a new auxiliary force to be called the Orientation Service. Its purpose was to take care of people who got lost in the ghetto. Theresienstadt was built as a garrison in the 18th century to accommodate 11,000 people. By July 1942, when Manners arrived, the population was over 50,000, with more transports arriving each day. Many inmates were severely disorientated and traumatized. Manners selected 12 Berliners to help him in his work, and the Orientation Service was started. The Ghetto Watch and the Orientation Service were part of the Jewish self-administration under the Council of Elders. The administration tried to maintain an appearance of normality in the pursuit of life in the ghetto, and the prisoners supported this make-believe by working where they could as nurses or doctors, craftsmen or librarians.
This make-believe reached its culmination in the so-called Town Beautification Programme of 1944, when the numbers of inmates were lowered by deportations to Auschwitz, trees were planted, a coffee house opened, and a cleaning programme ordered, all in preparation for a visit by a delegation of the Red Cross, which duly allowed itself to be taken in by the appearances. Manners records in his account his reaction to this beautification.
The work of the Town Beautification in the days before June 23 takes on a momentum that we haven't experienced before. The streets have never been swept so clean. Entire crews have been deployed to put the main street especially into tip-top shape. It is indeed our avenue of pomp and glory. It is beautiful on a clear day when the mountain seems so close that the light green of the deciduous forest can be clearly distinguished from the dark fir forest. Up high, the bare areas near the summit, where the snow held fast for so long, can be seen. A particular effort was made to spruce up the Seestraße. The windows of the houses are fitted with flower boxes planted with hanging petunias. The mirror-like windows were hung with white curtains. The shops being used for accommodation also have beautiful curtains or were painted white. Light-colored sand covers a carefully raked path. All the houses had to be cleaned and washed, the courtyards spotless, and the ash cans dead straight. Every inhabited space has to reflect comfort. Nothing should be left hanging around to get in the way. Why this campaign of tidying and cleaning? Supposedly a commission from neutral countries is coming to inspect the ghetto. According to another rumor, they would be high-ranking men from Berlin. Say what you will, this massive and necessary cleaning operation cannot be praised highly enough. No matter what the reason for it is. After all, we know from our experience in the military what to do there was when an inspection was announced. Regardless of whether it was the barracks or we who were inspected, we had to get down and work. It did us no harm. In any event, we in Theresienstadt benefit from the mystery visit. There is more to eat. For lunch, we get a thick slice of salami and a whole fresh Swede, cut into thin slices, which tasted very good raw, sprinkled with sugar. In the evening, there was a potato and a bosniaka, a large roll made from strong-tasting rye flour. It is a welcome change. Moreover, the bread we are getting is excellent. It is no longer moldy, as it was in 1942, but dry and well-kept, and it tastes good.
The work of the orientation service was, on the whole, rather mundane, but there was another aspect to it. It was assigned room 38 of the Magdeburg barracks, and this became what the musician Willy Dürer called a curious mixture of police station, theatre, adult education centre and concert agency. Manners used the orientation service as the vehicle for organising lectures and cultural evenings, which eventually numbered over 500 events. In the next reading, he describes some of the events from 1943.
The musician Willy Dürer from Breslau introduced a completely new note into the series of presentations. I had requested him for the auxiliary service of the ghetto watch, and he was quickly confirmed. Dürer got to work cheerfully and energetically, and in a short time put together a first-rate choir whose performances quickly won favour in our circle. There were evenings of folk songs featuring solo performances. Kurt Messerschmidt, 28 years old, blonde and very handsome, sang German and Yiddish songs accompanied by a lute. Mrs. Edith Weinbaum presented an evening of Schubert, which concluded with improvised Schubert melodies played by Alfred Loewy on the harmonium. Song and chorus in antiphony seemed like a fresh drink from a forest spring and refreshed both the audience and the performers. All the lectures attained a high level. A former senior civil service engineer, Robert Stricker, spoke about his friendship with Papa Lynckeus from Vienna and painted a vivid picture of the man and his work. On the days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, weighty lectures were held. Rabbi Dr. Leo Beck, Rabbi Albert Schön, and Rabbi Heinz Meyer. Dr. Leopold Neuhaus spoke about the Psalms, and the Dora mixed choir sang them. These evenings were solemn and formed a bridge to the Day of Atonement, on which I twice held overcrowded prayer hours. Hanukkah, on December 21, began with a celebratory talk by Rabbi Albert Schön, framed by the Dora choir. Two fairy tale evenings for adults were much enjoyed. Jewish fairy tales and some by Andersen were read. Dr. Kurt Singer from Berlin, the founder and head of the Kulturbund, came here in autumn from his Dutch asylum and took an enthusiastic interest in all artistic endeavors. He held many lectures. For me, he spoke about the aim and purpose of music. His easy, charming conversational tone pleased the audience very much. This animated man, with his white head, wraith-like face, and expressive hands, received hearty applause. Vale, every time Verdi's Requiem is performed here, it is a funeral celebration for Kurt Singer and for all the prominent men who died here in Theresienstadt. Requiescat in pace rings for each one of them. It is like a soft prayer on wings of music, rising up to every spirit that has become joined with the infinite.
From the beginning of 1943, Marnes held lectures every evening because the demand was so great. On the 10th of March, he marked his 100th event. By the summer of 1943, lectures were regularly interspersed with play readings and musical performances. The lectures went on throughout 1943 and 1944, and the 500th took place in August 1944. The speaker was Rabbi Leo Beck, the great Jewish thinker and the last head of the Jewish community of Germany.
And now the 500th lecture evening. I welcomed the listeners, gave a short overview of the founding of the lecture series on September 21, 1942, and what had been achieved since. I read statistics that provided a picture of these 2 years. Then I remembered the many deceased actors and speakers, and the audience rose from their seats. Then I invited Dr. Beck to rise to give his lecture, Epochs of Life. Dr. Beck spoke standing up with captivating warmth and generosity. For over an hour, he held us under the spell of his words. A life blossomed before us, the life we all share, and gave us a motto: one does not become old if one does not forget one's childhood. The skill with which Dr. Beck developed this theme and wove it together gave us a rare experience. And now an epilogue. On the next day, I met Dr. Beck on the redoubt. He came to me and thanked me for the beautiful evening. That was for me unforgettable. A beautiful and poignant testament of the humility and modesty of this great Jewish philosopher. 500 evenings are behind me. I missed only a very few because of illness. I look back on this period happily. It gave me a life that accorded with my wishes and desires, a chance to be creative and to achieve things to the extent of my abilities, and an inner satisfaction that fully reconciled me to the fate that had brought us to Theresienstadt. I feel most grateful for the loyalty of the many listeners who so often shake my hand and thank me for what I give them in these evenings. Isn't that the best reward? Do I still need acknowledgement from above? No. That they still come despite the heat and mugginess of the hot attic is the most convincing affirmation. My path is the right one. If I remain healthy, I want to continue, regardless of what goes on around me. I do not listen to what others say to me every day. I do not take my lead from the actors who only want to get parts for themselves with their suggestions. I set up the program so that I can answer for it artistically and do not allow myself to be influenced by anybody. I will keep it this way until that day when the outside world calls to us. Come back to your life. Come back to freedom. May God give me the strength to reach that moment.
Towards the end of his account, Manners begins to describe the transports rolling out of Theresienstadt for Auschwitz. From 1944, the transports dominated everything, and Manners sensed his fate approaching. Before long, women were included in the transports, and then the age limit rose from 50 to 65. More and more of his friends went. Philip and Gertrude Manners realized that the age limit would rise again and that they would be called up. And yet they carried on helping people to prepare for the transports until the last one, which they themselves had to join.
When I came home, the latest notification had already been posted everywhere. All persons up to age 65 must prepare for transport and have luggage weighing up to 30 kilograms ready for call-up on the night of Saturday to Sunday, October 8. This new and frightening proclamation struck the inhabitants of the ghetto like a bolt of lightning out of a clear blue sky. We had reckoned that work transports would still go up to the age of 60, but we were completely unprepared for the extent of this. It meant evacuation of everyone but the old and infirm. Petrified, we sat in our room. The first call-ups came towards the evening, and the enormous sorting and packing began. What has to be left behind from 2 years' accumulation? How does one choose? Which method of rolling and tying everything up is the most secure? It has become quiet in the house and the courtyard. The noisy Brockman children, who got on our nerves from the first thing in the morning until the last thing at night, have gone. The mistress of the warming kitchen, Dr. Löwenstein, left with her husband and daughter, and a sign on the door reads, "Closed." Our rooms, once noisy and overcrowded, are nearly empty. What a transformation! What a Sukkot! What a Simchat Torah celebration! A hard week lies before us. We too will prepare for departure. We are in no way safe, because every hour can bring new orders. One notices the first signs. The Czech gendarmes close off the station road. From that moment on, the call can take place at any minute, and boarding the train can begin. On Sunday, the original date, complete calm. There were some exemptions and rearrangements, but they do not change the number. The night passed undisturbed. The morning dawned hazy. Low clouds covered the sky. It drizzled continuously, settling the dust on the road, which was welcome. It drizzled continuously, settling the dust on the road, which was welcome. This transport deeply affects the existence of the ghetto. And if the transports with the numbers of 3 times 2,000 are really carried out as announced, Theresienstadt will exist only as an old people's home in which 70-year-olds belong to the youngest group.
Philip and Gertrude were taken to Auschwitz. Their transport arrived there on the 20th of October. Of the 2,038 people on the transport, 1,689 were gassed immediately. Philip and his wife were almost certainly in this number. When Philip Manners was deported, he entrusted his papers to a fellow inmate, Lias Klimek. She preserved them through the liberation and eventually managed to transmit them to Philip's boyhood friend, Adolf Frank, in Bavaria. Frank had maintained contact with Manners during his incarceration and knew the whereabouts of his daughter, Eva Manners. Eva and her sister Anna Marie had fled to Britain in 1939. Eva was working as an office manager in Oxfordshire in 1948 when the papers reached her. She died in 2004 at the age of 95. It was she who deposited them at the Wiener Library in 1995. The Manners collection at the Wiener Library comprises 16 boxes of manuscripts and the letters of the Manners family. You can find more information about the library at www.wienerlibrary.co.uk. We would like to thank the Wiener Library, Ben Barkow and Klaus Leist for helping us to record this podcast. The book, As If It Were Life, by Philip Manners, edited by Ben Barkow and Klaus Leist, is available now, published by Palgrave.